Scene 15, Sarah Voskovic, 5 p.m. It was just about 5 o'clock when I heard her footsteps outside. I had no doubt it was she, short footsteps, fussy but firm, with the high heels making sharp clicking noises. I stood up. She walked in, looked at me, stopped in clear consternation, and said, "Is something wrong, Darius?" I said, "I want to speak to you." She said, "Can you wait a bit till I clear up some things? Will you have to rush away to go home then?" "No," she said doubtfully. "Not if it's something important." "It's important." "Then please wait." She didn't seem unduly disturbed. I sat down again and returned to my fidgeting. After a while, Ginger stacked some papers neatly at one side of her desk, made some scrabbling noises under the desk, which I interpreted as getting her shoes on, and took her purse out of a desk drawer. She said in a brisk voice, "I'm leaving, Sarah." I took it she was giving fair warning that we would be alone together. She smiled at me as she left, wishing me luck, I think, which was nice of her, but inappropriate to the occasion. Sarah's voice came back, clear and serene. "Very good, Ginger. Have a nice evening." 2 more minutes passed. Sarah came into the outer room, looked casually out into the hall, then closed the door softly, pulled down a shade, and motioned me into the inner room. "If you want to talk further about our last topic of conversations," she said, "we couldn't do it with anyone else here, you understand." I sat down on the couch in her office. She remained standing. I said, "Did you know the hired hands around here call you Little Pepper?"
"I've heard the phrase," she said indifferently. "Where did you hear it?"
I ignored her question. I said, "You heard Giles DeVore speak my name in hatred, through clenched teeth, I imagine."
"Clenched teeth or not, he did."
"I'm sure of it. Not, however, at the autographing session. There were 3 people near him, part or all of the time. There were Isaac Asimov, Teresa Valliere, and Nellie Griswold, and not one heard him say a thing about me."
She said, "I didn't say it was at the autographing session. I believe I said later."
"I don't remember your exact words," I said. "I got the impression, however, that it was at the autographing session." "I was wrong, I suppose. And I'm not surprised, since I'm a very poor detective. I'll accept your statement now that it was later, but might it not have been earlier?"
"Why earlier?"
"You were here at the beginning, weren't you? When you apologized to Asimov and asked after me."
"I told you about that."
"Yes, and about the time when Asimov was talking to you, he became aware that Giles was present, so I suspect you two came in together."
"I leave you to your suspicion."
"It's more than a suspicion. None of the press people will admit to having escorted Giles to the autographing room, but someone did because the cloakroom girl saw him that morning. He tried to get a package for which he didn't have the ticket, and the cloakroom girl said Little Pepper urged him onward lest he be late." "How about that, Little Pepper?" Sarah took the seat behind her desk, placing 3 feet of steel between us. She said,
"I haven't lied to you. He did make it clear that he was furious with you, and there was unpleasantness at the session, and I had apologized to Asimov, and he had also found out who you were. I came to warn you of Mr. DeVore's fury, and that was it."
"I have no quarrel with that, but you didn't tell me the whole truth, did you? You didn't say you had been with him before the autographing session." I paused a moment, then decided to say it. "Or possibly the whole previous night as well?" I was prepared for a storm, but she only reddened a bit and clasped her hands tightly together so that the knuckles whitened as they interlaced on her desk.
"If I had," she said, "then it would be no business of yours. But as it happens, I hadn't. I was at home that night in my own bed and alone. If you don't believe that, there's no need for you to sit here and ask me any more questions. But if there was nothing to hide, why not tell me you had been with DeVore before the autographing session?"
"Why on earth should I tell you? I told you all I felt it was appropriate for you to know. I didn't know the man was dead at the time, and that you suspected murder later on. And if I had known, there was still no reason to tell you, since you aren't the police. You still aren't right now, and I don't have to tell you anything."
I said, "No, I'm not the police. Still, if you're worried over my getting into trouble over this matter of drugs, then don't mislead me and let me run the chance of getting into trouble through ignorance or misapprehension."
the death of Devore can't have anything to do with drugs. I don't accept that. But if there's anything you can tell me that will show that you're right, I will change my mind. So please, tell me. Tell me everything that happened from the moment you saw him yesterday morning. She stirred uneasily in her chair. She said, All right. This is how it went. About 9 a.m. yesterday, not long after I got to work. By the way, I said, how is it you were working Memorial Day?
I've told you, haven't I? We've got a major advertising campaign coming up, and the art department has flubbed it. So I've been here all weekend, and so have they.
And the security chief, what's his name, Marsogliani? He was here, too. Is he involved in the advertising campaign also?
No, he's not, she said, with just a touch of acid. But he's always here when there's a major convention at the hotel.
Why? Do you think we all got here on an off day to work out a conspiracy against your friend? I felt a little foolish under the lash of her contempt and said, No, I'm just trying to ask all the questions I can think of. I added humbly, I'm not very good at it. She was mollified.
All right, but don't worry about us. We make up any off days we lose.
Well, then what happened at 9 a.m., not long after you got to work?
I got word from the desk that there were peculiar phone calls arriving from room 1511.
Why did they report that to you? Why not to Marsogliani?
Marsogliani hadn't arrived yet. And in any case, minor troubles come to me occasionally. I have a perhaps exaggerated reputation in the hotel as a fix-it of miscellaneous mix-ups.
Well, what did you do?
I checked on the occupant of the room, and it was Giles Devore. That concerned me because he was a VIP at this convention, and if something was wrong with him, it might mean unpleasant publicity. I decided to go up to the 15th floor.
What were the phone calls about? I asked, without the slightest doubt as to what they were about.
The desk clerk who had received the calls wasn't sure. He said they were garbled and incomprehensible, and at one point it sounded as though he were weeping. The clerk suggested that I call a doctor.
Maybe you should have.
Not at all. If a resident at the hotel wants a doctor, that's one thing. You can't force a doctor on him, however, without his consent, unless you have reason to think he is in no position to give consent. I went up to check. He answered the door, fully dressed, but with his hair grotesquely uncombed, and with an oddly feverish look in his eye. The room was in complete disarray. He said, Are you the cloakroom woman? I told him who I was, and he said, Please come in and help me. I went in. I was upset at his obvious misery. I've read his book, you know, and I admired it, and here was the author.
Yes, yes, I said. What happened after you went in?
She said, He sat down on the bed with his face all twisted as though he were on the point of crying. He said, I've looked all over. It isn't here. I said, What isn't here? He said, The package. It's not here. It was supposed to be here last night, but I forgot. I was busy.
I seized upon that. He was busy? Did he say with what? Sarah shook her head.
I can't repeat what he said exactly. It was all very confused and repetitious, and it's not as though I had a tape recorder there.
Tell me what you can.
I'll give you the impression I gathered. He had come to his room fairly late the night before from some television taping session, and he hadn't been entirely well. There was a woman with him, and he had needed help badly, but she was a bad woman.
A bad woman?
That's what he said, over and over.
He didn't name her?
No, he didn't, and I didn't ask.
No, of course not. Please go on. She said,
He had needed help, and she wouldn't help, or not enough, even though he had begged and pleaded. And when I asked, in what I hope was a cool and businesslike voice, if he wanted a doctor, he said no, very emphatically. He then went on to explain, quite repetitiously, that he had needed help, and she wouldn't help him. He was very sorry for himself, almost disgustingly so. He was destroying my respect for him, and I was embarrassed to be there.
I said, Was it your impression that he was under the influence of drugs?
The thought didn't occur to me, but if it had, how could I possibly have been able to tell?
She hesitated for quite a while, and since it seemed to me she was trying to say something, I kept quiet and let her struggle. Finally, she said,
I shouldn't tell you this. It's confidential.
The autopsy has been performed, and security received a copy a couple of hours ago. I saw it, and there are no signs that he had been taking drugs. I was glad to hear that. Then that's one thing we can eliminate. As I told you, drugs had nothing to do with Mr. DeVore's death.
Yes, but you didn't tell me why. At that, though, he didn't have to be an addict. Drugs could have been involved in his death if he were a pusher.
She grimaced. Do you think he was a pusher, that poor, flabby little boy?
Little boy? He was a hulk.
What's that got to do with it? Little boys come in all sizes. I could see him as an addict, but not as a pusher.
I can't either, to be honest with you, but it's got to be something, doesn't it, to account for the murder?
Not at all. His death could be an accident. Everyone but yourself is sure it was.
I shrugged. Well, go on.
She said, he went on to say that he had felt so ill after this unsympathetic woman, he kept calling her bad, left, that he just went right to sleep without ever thinking about the package.
Do you think he was telling the truth?
She said, why should he have lied?
I don't know. Do you think he was telling the truth?
How can I possibly know?
What was your impression?
I assumed he was telling the truth. As I look back on it, I'm reasonably sure he was. He was too upset and too out of control to lie. Unless you're pathogenic about it, it takes considerable effort to make up a lie. Was he a pathogenic liar?
I thought about it. No, I can't say I recall him lying to me, not even under provocation.
He knew you well, then.
I lived with him for a considerable time, I said dryly, in the non-sexual sense of the term.
Then I would say he was telling the truth.
Let's assume he was. Then after the woman left, he went to sleep, and can we further assume that he had awakened not long before your arrival?
Some time before, there was a cup of coffee on the telephone table that was half full and had probably been made with the electric coffee maker.
You mean that he hadn't called room service for breakfast?
No, I don't think he did. It's easy enough to check that out with room service, however.
Well, if we have to, we will. But if he slept all night, then that would mean he hadn't left the room, and possibly the hotel, in search of a woman who would be sympathetic. And if he hadn't done that, then we lose a large possible source of motivations for the murder.
You're still convinced it was murder?
Yes. And if the night is closed off, that leaves us with the missing package as the only unusual thing that could explain the whole tragedy. I dislike that.
Because it isn't motive enough?
I don't see how it can be. But mainly I dislike it because I was supposed to bring it to his room night before last, and I didn't. That was the errand I told you I had forgotten yesterday afternoon. Unless, of course, there's something we still don't know about. In all the time you were with him, Sarah, did he say anything, do anything, give you any impression at all that something was bothering him other than the package?
The woman of the night before, whoever she was bothering him, she said firmly, but except for that, it was the package all the way.
All right, go on then.
She said, once he woke up, he said, he remembered the package and started looking for it. He was in a state of fury, I suppose, that made him pretty irrational, for he tore the bed apart, had all the towels on the floor, the blankets out of the closet, and so on. He might have had some dim thought that you had hidden the package in order to annoy him.
I shook my head. It would never have occurred to me.
Then he called the desk. I gather he was trying to ask if the cloakroom attendant still had the package, or if not, to whom she had given it.
I said, listen, when he came back the night before, he could have gotten the package, couldn't he? How late are the cloakrooms open?
Till midnight.
And if he didn't have a ticket?
That could have been complicated. Still, if he had been able to identify the package, it could have been opened in the presence of the assistant manager.
Did he tell you what was in the package?
No. Do you know?
Yes, I do. Pens. Monogrammed pens. Total worth maybe $10. And if he had had it opened, his name on those pens would have proved his ownership.
That idiot, dead or not, I've got to call him an idiot.
If he had just held on to his damned ticket, he could have gotten his package when he came back.
There are many people like that, said Sarah. They take precautions. They worry about taking chances. I suppose he thought that if he didn't ask you to get the package for him, he would worry all evening long that the cloakroom might be closed when he returned.
and that would have affected his television taping.
Yes, I suppose so. Please go on.
It was about 9:30 by then, and he said he had an autographing session at 10. So I said, well, let's clean up your room and go. I'll see to it that you get your package if it's still in the cloakroom. I was trying to calm him down, you understand, because it seemed to me he was dangerously close to going out of control. Are you sure, Darius, that the package contained only pens?
Not sure, I said cautiously, in the sense that I ever saw the contents, but Mrs. DeVore said they were pens in there, and I'm sure it's so.
You have to understand that Giles is compulsive. When things don't follow the scenario he has prepared, he goes wild.
Besides, he was trying to change publishers, and between being afraid of losing a big chance and being afraid he was being unethical, he was probably very much uptight and on edge. And besides, I wanted to go on and say that since he had failed to work off his little boy syndrome with Henrietta the night before, he was still a little boy. Sarah had described him exactly that way, as a matter of fact. Certainly he acted like a little boy over the pens going dry, but I kept it to myself. I wasn't going to give her anything that would guide her in what she had left to tell. I said, "So you cleaned up the room?"
"Yes. I didn't vacuum it, you understand, but I put back the blankets and towels and made the beds. He didn't help much."
"His clothes were neatly hung up or put away?"
"Oh, yes. They were that way to begin with."
"You didn't leave any clothes hanging around on the chairs or bed?"
"No," she said firmly. "By the time I was done, it was about 10 minutes to 10, and I felt it was my responsibility to get him down to the autographing. It wasn't too hard to lead him, though I kept thinking that I had a robot by the elbow, one who would go wherever pressure impelled him, but would stop if he were released and just stand in one spot indefinitely. Once we were in the elevator, however, he did insist on going to the cloakroom. I was in no position to make a scene, since the elevator, I assure you, was not empty. So we stopped off at the second floor. I knew it would be difficult to negotiate anything quickly with Hilda. She's a rather hard-bitten attendant, and we had only a few minutes. When she balked at handing over something without a ticket, I urged DeVore on, telling him I would get the package for him in a few minutes, as soon as he was safely delivered to the autographing session.
But you didn't get the package, did you?
No, she said, with a shake of her head. I was just keeping him quiet. Besides, I didn't think there was any point in getting it till he was through with the autographing. It never occurred to me that he needed it for the autographing, and he never told me what it was. Even if I had known it was pens, though, it would have seemed to me that the world is full of pens, and you could borrow one from anyone about you.
Not a monogrammed DeVore pen out of which to manufacture a monogrammed DeVore book.
Well, I didn't know that, you see.
All right. Go on.
We got into the autographing room, and he pulled away from me at once, as though he were coming to life again.
I let him go, figuring he could find his way to the stage himself, and he did. I saw him in his seat after a while.
And no one saw you come in with him?
People saw him and people saw me, but I don't know if anyone saw us both together. The place was crowded as we walked in, because another autographing session was just finishing up, and DeVore pulled away from me at the threshold.
You must have stayed there, though. You knew about the fuss Giles had made, or did someone tell you?
No, I remained. I noticed Asimov standing there, and I felt impelled to go to him and apologize for my attitude the night before. I had come on a little strong, but, you know, I was having trouble with the art people, and the pressures on me were a little intense. He was nice about it, and I asked him who you were, and he told me, and that rather flabbergasted me.
But you didn't run to me at once and apologize, I said, with what must have been an annoying touch of irony. She refused the bait, and I was relieved at that, for it hadn't come out the way I had intended. She said,
No, I wouldn't have known where to find you, though it did occur to me I might get to you at the luncheon, as I did, you know. Meanwhile, I stayed there because Asimov amused me. Have you ever seen him sign autographs?
Yes, I said unenthusiastically. She smiled.
He's such a feckless lecher. Pants indiscriminately after every girl who shows up. An absolute democrat who pays no attention to race, creed, color, age, or previous condition of servitude, I said.
I know. I guess it is fun the first time you watch it.
Yes, it is.
He turns every statement, however innocent, into a heavy-handed double entendre, and manages it in so inoffensively self-delighted a way that somehow no one minds. He's like a big puppy dog bouncing around and... I got her off the subject.
And you stayed there all the time till there was the fuss in connection with Giles?
Yes, and then I stayed on to the end because I was still feeling responsible for him and because I was afraid that something unpleasant might happen that would result in the kind of publicity that the hotel would not want.
You didn't hear him say anything about me during that time?
No, not then.
When did you hear it?
When the autographing session was over. He threw the pen he had been using against the wall. It hit and fell to the ground.
The red ink pen?
I don't know what kind it was, but he was clearly furious and perhaps out of control. He stood up and walked to the door. Some people tried to stop him and talk to him, but he paid no attention. It seemed to me he was swaying, and I was afraid he would collapse. My feeling of responsibility overcame me again, so that I followed after him quietly, took his arm, and led him to the elevators.
And what happened then?
As we were walking to the elevators, I asked him if he wanted to stop at the cloakroom for his package, and he said, "Too late." And then, in a kind of whisper, that Darius Just," he said it with such hatred that it just chilled me. There was a homicidal edge to his voice, and even though he struck me as being a child, he's such a physically large man, and you're so...
"Small," I suggested, when her hesitation had grown perceptible. She hurried on.
"I felt you ought to be warned."
"But you didn't run and warn me right then, did you?"
"As I told you, there was no way I could have found you then. Besides that, I had to take him up to his room."
"And what happened when you did that? Did you leave him there? Did you walk in with him? What?" Now she was in trouble. She took to shuffling some of the papers on her desk. Then she looked up and said in a small voice,
"I've told you everything that's important."
I said, "Why not just lie to me and tell me you took him to his room and walked away without entering?"
"How do you know that would be a lie?"
"Because I've discovered things about Giles. We can be reasonably sure that he was left frustrated by the events of the night before, and there had been no relief since then. The failure to get the package, the fiasco at the autographing session, must all have accentuated the needs he felt. I am quite certain that even if you wanted to leave him in his room, you wouldn't have been able to. He took you by the arm, didn't he, and drew you in. And what could you do? He's so large and you're so small." She said miserably,
"Yes, he drew me in."
"And once he had you in, he began to cry, and then he asked you to undress him and give him a bath?" She looked me straight in the eye and said bitterly,
"You know, then, you've lived with him.
Does he do it all the time? And he's never tried to get help?" I shrugged. "My living with him has nothing to do with it. I just found out about this yesterday. And why should he get help? If he finds a girl who doesn't mind cooperating, who's hurt?" She didn't say anything, and after a few moments I asked in a flat, quiet voice, "Did you cooperate?" She rose from her chair so she could lean toward me, and for the first time I saw her actively angry.
"No, I did not. When he told me what he wanted, I left."
"You couldn't have left if he tried to stop you."
"He didn't try to stop me. I left quickly, in a hurry. I was near the door and out. He couldn't have moved fast enough to stop me."
"I see." Sarah said thoughtfully, "I suppose that woman the night before had also refused."
"Yes, she had." "And that's it?"
"Is it?" I said. "You got him up to his room after the autographing sessions, shall we say 11:10?
"About that."
"And you came to the luncheon and warned me of Giles' anger with me at about 1 o'clock, nearly 2 hours later."
"I couldn't have found you immediately. Did you expect me to wander about the hotel aimlessly, trying to meet you by chance?"
"What did you do during those 2 hours?"
"I was in my office. I had plenty to do."
"Who saw you there?"
"No one."
"My receptionist was out. It was Memorial Day, remember?"
"You have no alibi."
"Why would I need one?" Her eyes were fixed on mine, and I could see the anger surge upward again. "Your story is unsupported," I said. "Giles said he slept all that night and was not with a woman, and if he said so, as you reported he did, I would believe him. But I have only your report to that effect. I have only your report as to what happened before and what happened after the autographing session."
You could be lying.
Lying? What do you imagine did happen?
You're a small woman, I said easily, lounging back on the couch, but a dominating one. You run a department here with authority, and you're used to putting down large men. You may even like it. Now here was a large man who wanted to be dominated. You might have stayed with him all night, or if not... I waved aside the beginning of an angry statement from Sarah, and I admit it sounds unlikely. Then you might well have helped him out Monday morning, especially afterward. Sarah was back in control. Go on, she said out of tight lips. You said you had been feeling responsible for him all morning. You led him by the arm back to his room, felt sorry for him, and might even have enjoyed undressing him and bathing him. There's no harm in it. Two consenting adults and all that?
I see. And if so, what are you getting at?
Why, if so, you might well have been there when he died. I sat up suddenly and said sharply, What happened? And it was as though all the anger died in her at once and washed out. She laughed in complete good humor and said, That's funny. Then she laughed again. I began to feel foolish. What's funny?
The way you did that. Sitting up suddenly like a schoolteacher who was going to trap me into saying something I didn't want to say.
But you're not answering, she said in total good nature.
Because there's nothing to say. You don't really believe I'm lying. You're just testing me, and I assure you I pass. I brought him up about 11:10 a.m., and it couldn't have been much past 11:15 when I left, 11:20 at the outside. I left him there crying, poor fellow, but I assure you I had nothing more to do with him than I have told you. Of course, yes, I do have a little sadness over not having perhaps been a little kinder when he tried to take his shower by himself in his condition.
Everyone tries to be responsible, I said querulously. Now look, are you certain that when you left there were no clothes scattered about the room?
I tell you,
and her usual precision of language became even more pronounced,
that when I left he had his clothes on his body. Not one item had been removed.
All right. Now then, when you left, was anyone in the corridor?
No.
Are you sure?
Quite sure. Look, Darius, I've made love, you understand, and with a certain reasonable variety of technique, too. But this was something quite new and repellent to me, and it was advanced by someone whom I found completely uninteresting, sexually, and I felt shocked at the whole thing, even though I wouldn't have thought anything sexual could shock me. Why are you looking at me like that, Darius? Did you think I was a virgin? I'm 32 years old, and I have a 7-year-old son.
I spread out my hands. Sorry, I hadn't really thought of it at all, except that your name fits your accent, so I thought you were unmarried. Of course, you could have married a fellow countryman and your husband's name,
or I could be divorced and be working here under my maiden name. Isn't that possible, too?
Oh, is that it?
Does it matter? Are you interested?
I didn't really know what to say, so I settled for the truth. No, it doesn't matter, but I guess I'm a little curious.
I'm divorced, she said. And your marital status?
I'm single, I said quickly.
Always?
Never been married, though I guess it won't shock you if I tell you I'm not a virgin either.
I wouldn't have believed you if you had said you were, she said ironically. But let me explain how I know the corridor was empty. When I left DeVore's room, I felt somehow dirtied, and I had an intense desire for no one to see me leave the room. I felt that too much, perhaps everything, could have been guessed from my appearance.
Your clothes were must?
Don't be foolish. It was a purely neurotic feeling. In any case, I didn't want anyone to see me, and I took special note of the fact that no one did. There was no one in the corridor.
No one at all?
She hesitated. Well, I did have the impression that there was a flash of movement in the direction of his room when I turned into the elevator bank recess. It might have been a bit of fearful apprehension.
Anything more specific than just a flash of movement?
No. Since I didn't want to be seen, or worse yet, be caught by DeVore if he was following me, I slipped down the staircase to the floor below and took the elevator there.
Too bad, I said. Was there no impression of any kind other than the flash of movement? Could you tell whether whatever you saw was large or small, man or woman?
No, nothing.
Too bad.
If you did leave by 11:20, and if I found him dead 2 hours later, at which time he had been dead for some time, isn't it possible that the flash of movement you saw was the murderer coming up to see Giles?
Goodness.
I sat there for a while, unable to think of any further questions to ask her. It was well after 6. I said, "Do you have to go home?"
"I usually do, eventually."
"I mean, I suppose you have to get back to your son."
"No, he's with his grandmother, my ex-mother-in-law. They have rights in him, too, and the divorce was not an excessively unfriendly one. It wouldn't be, since I asked for no alimony."
"Oh, well then," I grew suddenly animated, "would you care to have dinner with me?"
"Will we be talking about Mr. DeVore?"
I decided to be honest.
"We might, a little, because that's all I've been able to think of for about 30 hours now. But I promise I'll make an honest effort to talk of other things." "In that case, all right. I accept your invitation, Darius."